Hey Fixers, I'm Dr. Jeanette Benegas, one of the co-founders of FixSLP. Our platform exists to discuss the biggest challenges that are currently holding back the field of speech-language pathology. We present the issues with facts and invite you to be a part of joining this movement to make things better one conversation at a time. So let's FixSLP. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Jeanette. I am co-host free today. I have on guest Jordan Levan from Fighting for My Voice. But before we get to him, I'm going to read a review. And this one is, this one's from singing.slp, who was last week's guest. He said, I, Kevin, was brought on the podcast this past week, and I can't say enough about Jeanette and the FixSLP Foundation that's been established. From her welcoming presence to the education, even to the willingness to learn from others, makes this show and platform one of my favorites. Honest, deep conversation stems from a true heart to get to know the individual and proposing ideas that shift the narrative to be a better speech community. I implore the fresh CF SLP, the newbie grad student, the tenured professor, the seasoned vet SLP, and everyone in between to tune into the podcast, give a follow, and donate to the cause that is not only making a difference, but is making history and bringing everyone along for the ride. Kudos, FixSLP. Please pause while I cry and pull out the tissues. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Singing SLP. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, it is. How are you?
We've been waiting for this moment for a while.
Hey, as I know, life threw out a lot of things at me.
And Jordan just messaged and he's like, hey, want to record? And I was like, yes, I am not letting this moment pass me by. In my pajamas. We both brushed our teeth for this moment.
I know. Now I'm drinking soda.
It's fine. I might pause to go get wine. We'll see. That's
fine. This week can have a fun episode. I'll be drinking my Pepsi.
The episodes are always fun. What are you talking about?
Yes, of course. But, you know, an added layer.
You might be the first non-SLP guest.
Oh, really? That's an honor.
We had an audiologist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say that and offend someone. But I really think you might be the first. How about non-clinical guest, baby? Which, that's a big deal.
Thank you. That's my honor.
Been fangirling over you since the day we started the Facebook platform, which I made in line at Disney World in September of 2023, because we created our platform. We pre-recorded some podcasts. I went on vacation and we started going viral, and it was clear that we needed a Facebook platform. So I set it up and Facebook showed me your face and said, It was like, follow this account. And I was like, well, why not? And here we are.
Yay.
I'm obsessed with your platform. What's that?
Thank you. Oh, I said, thanks, Facebook suggestions.
And I think in that time since September, it seems like your platform has gotten a lot of growth.
A lot of growth within the past few months. I've been on social media for 4 years now.
I'm going to credit that to us. We followed you and then you blew up.
Exactly. It's, you guys really helped me out. Thank you so much.
Yeah, because I actually thought you were a new account. Like, I didn't realize you had been established. I thought you were getting started the same time I was. And I was like, oh, this is so great. We're growing together. And then I started paying more attention. I'm like, wait, I think he's been around for a while.
Yeah, for a few years. Now, I did change my username on Instagram because not all of the accounts were under Fighting for My Voice at one time. I was like, let's name everything Fighting for My Voice.
That's your platform. That's your handle, Fighting for My Voice. I'm sure there are a bunch of listeners who don't know who you are or what you do. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So hi, my name is Jordan Lee Van. I run the social media platforms under Fighting for My Voice. And what Fighting for My Voice is that Fighting for My Voice is a page where I talk about my own personal life experiences growing up with childhood apraxia of speech and multiple disabilities. And Fighting for My Voice has a common theme that we all have to fight for our voice in some way, shape, or form. And I feel like there's a lot of ways where our voice can be either taken from us or a way where we might have to fight for our voice in some way, shape, or form. And that's really what Fighting for My Voice is for me and about my own self-growth and self-discovery along my own journey. Is I'm also the author of Jordan's World and Jordan's Journeys. I have published four children's books, and they're all about my real life experiences, also growing up with childhood apraxia of speech and really vital life lessons that I wish I would have learned when I was younger. But at the time of writing these books, I usually learn that life lesson during that time as an adult. And that's what kind of drives me to write books and to write about my life. I am also the president and founder of the Apraxia Foundation. We are a 501c3 nonprofit that helps individuals with childhood apraxia of speech and other related speech disorders afford research evidence-based services and communication devices. I founded the nonprofit. It was in June of 2021, and we have been so fortunate to help a lot of families afford speech services as well as communication devices, because we believe that communication is a basic human right and that all people deserve equal access to communication, because there's so many different things that might affect a person from getting the treatment that they need. So those are a few different things that I do, and it's really nice to be on here. Thank you so much for having me.
I love your platform because you are just unapologetically you.
Oh, thank
And
you.
I love that about what you're doing. You put yourself out there. You talk about your life. You talk about your communication struggles. You're in speech therapy, so you share that. So I just love it. I just think that's great. And I think we all need to be unapologetically who we are. And I also love that you're an advocate. You're not fixing SLP, but you are trying to make a situation better for a ton of people who struggle with communication. And very early on, you started sharing our content and saying, hey, like our speech therapists are important. We need to be supporting them in this effort. And that meant the world to me. So thank you for just putting us out there because it's true. We need all the support we can get from the Fix SLP platform.
There's honestly a lot of things that people don't know that SLP is really good through, and partially why SLPs are afraid to talk about this is that because SLPs are afraid to lose their job, because if you're going to have your livelihood literally threatened, where you wouldn't be able to afford housing and food and water, of course, like, you don't feel comfortable talking about these different things. But I'm not employed by anybody. I am employed to myself, so I can talk about whatever I want. So that's why I talk about it, because I can. But many people can't. Many people can't say that if they're actually employed by the public school system, that typically the caseloads are looking at probably 80 plus students on the average caseload. Our school-based SLPs are really stretched thin. They're really underpaid, and we really wonder why school-based SLPs, within a few years, they go and they open a private practice. Well, you don't get treated like you're garbage anymore. Like, that's a really great feeling for any person in any sort of profession, and it's really, really, really sad. But once again, SLPs are afraid to talk about these things. And if we're going to support people who have speech disorders, communication struggles, whatever that might be, it's not enough to only advocate for them. We have to advocate for the fields that help support them, because what are you actually doing if you don't do that? I don't know. That's just
Right.
that's my own personal opinion about it.
It's kind of an access to care issue, too. If we have our best clinicians leaving the school system, sometimes that's the only speech therapy a kid who really needs therapy is going to get.
Yeah,
And
for
we
sure.
want those great clinicians who love giving school-based services to stay with the schools. You know, I was a school SLP for 2 years, and it I mean, I didn't like kids, so maybe that was the problem.
Oh.
But also, as a new clinician, I was in the schools in year two, and I was in a charter school in year one, and it was a super great situation. I was half clinic, half in this charter school that was super supportive. It was not the typical situation. But in year two and year three, I was fully employed by the county. And I was in special needs classrooms and giving speech therapy to kids in grades kindergarten through eighth across four schools in the district. And the second year, I think I started with 73 or 75 kids. And supposedly there's a caseload cap of 80 in Ohio, but I hadn't even started looking at the new kindergartners yet. I hadn't gotten any referrals. This was going into the school year. And I said to my supervisor, "Hey, what I'm starting at 75, what am I supposed to do?" And she's like, "You just do the best you can. That's what you do." She's like, "You figure out how to see them." And that was the beginning of the end for, I mean, I guess it was already coming to an end. But yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, that's the kind of support that we get is just figure it out. And I
That's
left.
sad. I'm really, really sorry to hear
Yeah.
that. Definitely did
But
not see these or that.
that story's not unique. That's the thing. The
Oh.
story's not unique. And then the healthcare SLPs have the same type of problem, but it's productivity. You have to see so many patients in the hours that you're clocked in, and you have to be billing for so much time. And at like a 90 to 95% productivity rate, that gives you anywhere from 24 to 48 minutes to go to the bathroom, consult with doctors and nurses, bill, do your paperwork, plan materials. What even is that?
That's awful.
It's a mess. It's not something Fix SLP has taken on yet, but it might be coming. This one woman show might eventually take it on. Let's talk about your books. Tell me everything we need to know.
So how I first began writing the children's books, actually, it was in 2020 when we were all locked into our houses and we were all cooped up with our thoughts, which was very, 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 very fun. But it made me do a lot of self-reflection during that time about my own like personal journey and like what I personally had to learn and go through as a person to get to a place of self-acceptance and self-love. So from that, I had written my first book that it was called The Boy Who Couldn't Speak Yet. And the boy who couldn't speak yet for me was the feelings, the emotions, and words that the boy who couldn't speak yet all felt and wanted to say, but wasn't able to as a child. So that's why I wrote in the book to express those different things and how I found a place of self-love and self-hate. Acceptance while being a child, being very heavily bullied due to my speech disorder, might have gave me the impression that maybe I should feel otherwise about myself. So that's how I first wrote in my first book, and I published the books under the series Jordan's World. And Jordan's World was always a very unique concept to me because as a child, people would describe me as I was in my own like world, in my own bubble and such, but that was because I could not physically communicate with others. So Most of the time, yes, I was in my actual brain, if you will. And that's what Jordan's world is supposed to represent for me, is, my brain not being able to speak as a child. And there's a lot of common themes as you read through the books. So like if you read through like the boy who proved them wrong and the boy who spoke even when his voice shook, because as I kept on writing, like the titles just got longer and longer, if I'm honest. I just kept on writing. But you'll read a lot of themes that, like, in Jordan's world, like, he wanted everybody to be accepted for who they are versus the outside world. In many of the books, there's themes that the outside world might not have looked that way. So it was a very unique concept for me. So that's why I love Jordan's world. I wrote three books in the trilogy, and it just made sense for me to leave those three books within Jordan's world. So I had began writing books under the book series Jordan's Journeys. That is an extension of Jordan's world, because I didn't want to take away from Jordan's world, because those are about the years of my life growing up and being non-speaking. So not being able to physically speak at all as a child. I was able to use like to pronounce maybe like a few words here and there, but they were very inconsistent. And it takes you along the journey of age like 5 through 8. So it made sense to me to write Jordan's journeys to continue talking about these different experiences, but talking about Jordan kind of getting out of his own inner world and such, and what did types of like social relationships look like relationships with family members, making friends and different things like that along my own journey. So that's my kind of concept for Jordan's journeys as well. So I just got done writing my fifth book. I actually had to submit it to my editor at 5 p.m. So I'm excited. I haven't mentioned much about it because I'm honestly really scared, but I'm excited. I love the book idea. So
So, are these self-published or are they through a publisher?
these are self-published myself. I was really, to be honest, I was told with the first book, I was told that the first book would not sell, because it was really met with like, this is a very niche topic, and it really is. But for me, that's the whole more reason to write the book. It is very, very niche to some people. It's not going to be niche to the group of people that you are trying to really target and trying to get a hold of. So what was pretty funny about that is that actually with the first book, the boy couldn't speak yet. On pre-order alone, it sold around 2,500 copies, very, very roughly. So I actually took a screenshot of that and I sent it to the person who told me the book would never sell. And I was like, just so you know, my book, I was really petty. But
That's the kind of spice I like. This is why we're friends.
it was really funny though, to be honest, during that time, because I was like really crushed about it, to be transparent with you. And I just was like, I was very, very grateful that anybody wanted to order my book, yet alone that many pre-orders and such. But it just made sense for me to keep on self-publishing the books, because there's a lot of things that people may have wanted to take away or edit from the books. And just when you're writing about your real life experiences, like only you can report that. And I just didn't want there to be any sort of like filter on that part.
You did well. So where can people get them?
You can get them on Amazon, you get them on Barnes and Noble, Target, and Walmart.
Well, what if I want them signed?
You would go to fightingformyvoice.com/shop.
How about I just Venmo you and you give them to me when I bring you to Ohio?
Okay, well, that works out for me. You can then my
We'll work this out privately after the episode.
You're so
How do you
funny.
make the most money? That's how I will pay you. So we talked about your book. Before I
Thank
move
you.
on, is there anything else you want to say about your books?
A lot of children don't get to see themselves within these types of books, and that's one of the main reasons that really drove me to write the books, because when I was growing up, I would search for myself in like books or TV shows, just like people who spoke some sort of like that you could tell that had a speech difference of some kind, and I was never able to personally find that fit the realm of a apraxia, if you will. Even if it wasn't named a apraxia, if I saw a person represented with a speech disorder, it would have made me feel somewhat seen or heard, but I didn't see that in like any sort of books growing up, or like TV shows or movies or anything like that. So that was the more reason for me to write the book series. So I just loved that.
Are you familiar with Dolly Parton's Imagination Library?
Yes, I
You
love her. Oh my goodness,
need
she's
to
an
get your book
icon.
into that. First of all, in Ohio, when my daughter was born, they only did it in certain counties. And we lived in a county that did it. They get a free book until they're 5 every month. And then during COVID, the governor made sure that every child in the state got a free book. You have to sign them up for it, but it went to every county. So now every county in Ohio has it. And my son was already signed up too. So my son went through that. But not only do kids need to be able to see themselves in books, but also it's great exposure for kids who don't know what apraxia of speech is. And
Absolutely.
don't know that some kids are different. We're all different, right? We all have special things about us. We're all different. I think it's great exposure for kids who don't know someone with apraxia of speech. Like Sadie didn't know what that was when you gave her a shout out on your Instagram live and she thought it was the coolest thing ever. But it was also an opportunity to talk about, first of all, to explain one, what an Instagram live was, because she didn't understand how you were talking to her like that and it wasn't FaceTime. And two, what apraxia was. And so, that it was just a cool opportunity. So getting your book widely distributed like that would be so great for other kids who don't have the exposure.
It's I love that, and I also love your point in addition to that about it's really good for kids who do not have those troubles to learn from them. And
Yeah.
that's really what my books are personally about, or like life lessons that I learned. And I do reflect a lot on the books as well, that like being kind to others, that it's not about how we say the words, it's about what we have to say that really matters. Basically, kids need to learn how to be nice and how to include others, and everybody's different, and that's okay. Bingo. Next
There you
topic.
go. Wrap that right there. I am bad with numbers. I don't know how closely you follow this podcast, but I am not a numbers girl. So I was sitting here trying to figure out what year you were born. 97?
1997. Bingo. You're
Did
right
it.
again. Bingo, bingo, bingo.
And so I was trying to think about that because I was trying to think about what year you should have hit your expressive language milestones. So we're thinking like 99, 2000. And what was going on in the apraxia of speech world at that time? Because I am going to tell you what I learned in my undergraduate course.
Oh, please, please tell me.
And it is right about that time. So if you should have been talking around the year 2000, I was in undergrad in the very early 90s, or 90s, no, I'm not that old, in the very early 2000s. And we had the best professor. She was great. And she told us that apraxia of speech was largely not understood yet, and that it was the diagnosis that most people gave kids when they didn't know what was wrong with them.
Oh my goodness.
And that's what I learned about apraxia of speech. Right around the time you should have started talking, and I expect you were pretty delayed. So I'm really curious to know what age you started speech therapy and what the quality of those services were and how it developed as the years went on, because certainly we gained a much better understanding from the year 2000 to the year 2024.
Oh, wow. So I first began speech services at age 5, and I actually began talking at age 5. So I couldn't talk prior to age 5. The very early years of my life were honestly, they were honestly like based off of what I personally refer to as survival. So I was born 3 months premature with post real urethra valves. I was born with all of these rare things in quotations because I don't think these things are as rare as what we make them out to be and like true honesty. But second, all of these things that are really hard to pronounce, not only for a person who has speech apraxia, but they're just some difficult words. But I was born with that, and I was like a very sick baby, very sick kid. I lost a kidney and a half. So they actually thought at one time, because I was born 3 months premature, that somehow that would have some sort of indicator on like later on within my life that it would take me more time to talk. So there was just like a lot of misconceptions, of course. I think once again, a very common theme. And I began speech services at age 5. I got in speech services within the public school system. My first SLP did not know how to treat apraxia, but she knew that I had apraxia, but she didn't know how to treat it. So she would actually leave me outside of her room. So she was like, all of my classes were, they were like trailers outside, so we weren't in the actual building. We were in the trailers, and there was like a really long built-in deck that like you could go in between like the different classes. And she just would leave me outside of there. And her reason for that is because she didn't know how to treat apraxia. One, even if she didn't know how to treat it, you don't leave a child outside of your classroom. Like that doesn't make sense. But I'm just saying what her reason was. As I aged though, she left the school though. Something that you would probably find in interesting is that when she got caught for that, she actually came into the school in the middle of the night and took all of her files, including my file, and she left the school, and nobody heard anything from her. So that was kind of the end of that era. I went into my first grade SLP services, and it was once again was not getting the services that I needed. My first grade teacher said that she couldn't understand me the whole entire year. That's what she put on my report card or said to my mom, either or. That's what my mom told me. And then in my second grade year, that's kind of when things began to kind of change. My mom really started pushing more for the services, which she had been. But during this time, we also found out that my childhood apraxia of speech was also affecting my reading and my spelling as well. So I was going to go into my third grade year, and the core instruction would have changed from those being the things that you were learning to things that you need to know now in order to like learn further things. So that's when the services started to be like bumped up more. And I began getting like 5 times a week of sessions for like 45-minute sessions. So it was a really big change, and they really changed the approach that they were doing as well. So they switched it to doing a motor planning approach, which we know for apraxia is literally required. And then that's when I started to make like a lot of speech gains. And then I went 5 times a week for 45-minute sessions up until my 6th grade year. And I kind of then honestly just hit like a breaking point with it, because I went for so much for many, many years. And I feel like I was honestly very overworked, and I was really, really stressed out, and I wasn't really, and it wasn't a good fit for me. Like the school I was going to, I was really, really bullied because of my apraxia, amongst other things. So then I actually, once I was in my 6th grade year, like I straight up refused to go back because I couldn't handle it. And then I actually decided to go back when I was 20 years old, because I found that there were new life situations that nobody prepared me for as a child, of course. Like I had to go apply for jobs. I had to, there were college classes I was taking, and I saw those things were really effective. And I sought out help at a local college that had a grad program. And then I got to work with the grad students for around 3 years. And they were very eager to learn. So I had like a very positive experience with that. Those were absolutely great. And then I went for 3 years, and then I've been back to speech now for the past 2 months. And that was because I just got trained in Orton-Gillingham. I have my A associate's level now, but there were certain phonemes that I had really a hard time pronouncing. So I really needed help with trying to really master those phonemes. So those are kind of what the speech services have been like so far, very roughly within my life.
I mean, that kind of matches up with, when you were five, that was probably the year I had that class where I learned, like, we don't really know what it is. And I recognized, I told you I was in pediatrics my first 3 years, and I recognized, man, this is really a lacking area in my education. And so the year that I left, or it might have been the year before I left, to go into full-time adults and get my PhD, I actually sought out continuing education with at what was the time, I don't know if it still is, but a really well-known apraxia of speech program that clinicians will use, because I had a couple kids on my caseload throughout the years who really had a tough time, and I felt like I was doing a disservice by taking them on. And I just knew it was an area where probably I could have been better educated, but also the research was coming along. And so I wanted to stay on top of it. And then I never got to use it because then I stopped working with kids and switched to adults and haven't really had much. I have people who've had strokes who have apraxia, but not with kids. So I think it's probably still an area that speech pathologists could do better at. Case in point, I often teach motor speech at universities when
That's all.
I'm, because I'm an adult neuro professor, and motor speech includes apraxia and dysarthria and is very heavy in adult, but you still have to cover the pediatric side of that in those classes. And I always bring in guest speakers for apraxia of speech because I know that my education is so poor. I've not treated it in children since I got a good training. And that's been years. We're coming up on 15 plus years since I've had that training. So I've always brought in guest speakers for that, just so my students can get a little bit of a better education than what I can provide. But not every professor does that. They just
Yeah. And it's like really, and what I'm really, really shocked at though, that your professor had said during your class though, is that we know that people have it, but we don't know much about it yet. Because I've heard a lot that there's some professors that will say that this is so rare that you will never see a case of this within your lifetime. So there's no concerns about trying to learn this. Or either there's some pro professors, and I was trying to have one of my SLP friends tell me the professor's name, because I was going to email them and be like, this is real. Like, I'm a person who has it. Hi, what's up? Like, let's fight. No, I'm just playing. I want to fight a person. I couldn't hurt a fly. But there's some professors that will say, like this isn't real, or we think it's just something else, or yeah, and that's absolutely not true. And also, I think that once again, I feel like we've came a long way in terms of like the apraxia of speech world, but I do feel like there's a very large misunderstanding as well that this is a condition that gets better with quotations with an age, or that people with childhood apraxia do not need like speech services. Like, they're being lazy, they're being shy, they're being a avoidant and such, that we really see these kids become teens and adults who have childhood apraxia of speech, and people will go on to describe them as being like very, very shy, or like not talking much when they're wanting to talk, but physically they know it's difficult, of course. And we might see people with apraxia have, a lot of troubles making friends. As I was a co-author on a research study. This was in 2020, and when we had found that people with childhood apraxia of speech have more troubles making friends, more troubles with social relationships. And these were all things that I can personally say are very, very true. But you don't know how to tell a person when you're trying to talk with them that doesn't struggle with this, I'm having trouble getting this word out, or I'm trying to tell you something, but like my brain is just like not letting me say it. Like, those are not things that's within the norm. So we see a lot of these teens and adults grow up and learn how to mask it. So essentially what that will look like is they'll purposely avoid words or phrases that they know that they would have trouble saying, because you can just kind of feel it within your brain. For me, that's how I can feel it. I don't know how to describe it, but prior to me saying a word, I can feel like a certain amount of tension within my brain. So if I feel that tension, essentially what I used to do is that I used to avoid saying that word or phrase because I was trying to like mask it to a certain point, versus now, like, I'm willing to expand upon my speech. And if I do have speech difficulties, I actively work through them. But I had to learn that I wasn't supposed to outgrow apraxia, that childhood apraxia is lifelong, and that it's okay to have a speech difference. So there's nothing wrong with that. But I feel like where we're really lacking is that we're not teaching a lot about disability acceptance or disability pride. And I feel like we would have such greater outcomes if we taught kids to be who they are, and that there's nothing wrong with you, and to teach them the purpose of services. So the purpose of services is not to fix you, because you're not broken and you've never been broken. This is a tool to help you, because we want to know what you have to say. Sorry, I could rant, but it gets on my nerves. I'm like,
I love that though, that we're not going to fix you because you're not broken. Oh my gosh. We can fix SLP. We're not going to fix the kids with the apraxia of speech. Man, I just get to unload all of my complaints on you. I also find it just another problem that I've encountered as a professor in academia is I don't find that we should really be diagnosing or treating any condition if it's not in our scope of practice. And of course, everything is in our scope of practice, but if we don't have the specific training and tools to be making a diagnosis, we really shouldn't be. And in the last, I'd say, year and a half, I was working in a university clinic where there was a kiddo who very clearly had apraxia of speech. And so we did an evaluation, but I was the supervisor. These were first year grad students in their first clinic rotation. I'm an adult therapist. I've never diagnosed a childhood apraxia of speech, and it's been 15 years since I've been trained on it. I'm not about to rock a family's world and diagnose that today. We did an eval and then I gave them a referral. I said, we can try to treat this, but if you really want answers, it's best that you go to someone who really knows about this. And here's some phone numbers of people you can call and we can coordinate with them and have some continuity of care. But our clinic director did not like that I did that. We should be a full service clinic where we don't have to send families to other places. Well, I'm sorry, but we don't have a person in this clinic who can do that. And I feel like it's our responsibility to be modeling that for our students so they can see how to handle those situations too. I didn't turn them away from services. I told them what I thought was going on. I just said, I'm not comfortable giving you that diagnosis because I'm not trained to do that. Full
Absolutely.
stop. Like, here's some names. We'll still see you, but here are the people who really immerse themselves in this. And so what do you think about that?
I really think that if you, based off of what I read, I would personally find that if you're not like well versed in treating apraxia and you don't have the tools and the assessments and such, making that referral would be best practice because you wouldn't want to misuse or not a properly, give the testing to the child and then the results, if you're not well versed on them, once again, the results could be skewed and such, and then we wouldn't have like the most accurate picture. It's I would find that if you really do suspect, of course, childhood apraxia, just really making that strong referral and just saying like it's if your child does have apraxia, then the motor planning approach is going to be what's research evidence-based. So I would just really encourage you to act upon this referral, but it doesn't mean that the SLP at the end of the day has full control over that. They can try to refer out, but it is up to the parents if they do refer out. And then also we could go in the topic of if insurance will cover that, but that's a whole different topic that I get heated about. But I would make the referral.
Yeah.
I think you did what's best. Yeah.
Yes. Jordan improved. Thanks for confirming me.
It's really tricky because I was trying to think over it like within my brain and like be like, is there anything? But I don't think so. Because you wouldn't want to try to use the testing if you didn't know how to administer it. Like that wouldn't stand to reason for me.
But also, that's such a life-changing diagnosis.
Absolutely.
Do you want an orthopedic doctor telling you that you have a heart condition, that you have terminal cancer in, an organ? No. You want the specialist to tell you have terminal cancer in whatever organ it is, not the bone doctor. So why would I give someone a life-changing diagnosis? That really does then change the approach that they're going to use and the amount of therapy that they're going to need and the amount of time they're going to spend getting that therapy. As a mother, my world would be rocked. Why am I going to rock this family's world when I could be wrong?
I mean, like, absolutely. And I was going to say as well that I feel like we put too much pressure on our speech language pathologists, and we expect them, like, you guys have to learn a lot, a lot, a lot, a lot. And there's only like so much that you'll be able to practice, but I feel like people see SLPs that, oh, you treat speech, you should be able to take on anything when certain, doctors have certain pro, certain specialties. And I feel like that's how we need to start looking at the SLP field and just knowing that there might be certain SLPs that are more well-versed in certain conditions, and there might be some that are in other conditions, and that's okay. And that's okay. It doesn't mean that a person who doesn't practice a praxia is a bad SLP. It just means that they're not trained within that. So you see one that is.
We need SLPs need to be okay with that, and they need to get better at advocating for themselves when it comes to their caseload, because employers just expect you to know everything. And sometimes, faking it until you make it isn't the way to go because you're messing with people's lives,
Yeah,
right? Yeah.
absolutely.
What else? 501c3?
501c3. Oh yeah.
Tell me
It's,
more about it.
yeah, so I'm founder and president of the Apraxia Foundation, Hearing All Voices, where we help individuals who have childhood apraxia of speech and other related speech disorders be able to afford research evidence-based services, then also AACD devices as well. So I first founded the foundation in, it was June of 2021, and what had really in so what really inspired me during that time to find the Apraxia Foundation is I began talking about, my lived experiences with childhood apraxia of speech. I began my advocacy for childhood apraxia of speech and other sorts of disabilities as well. And I heard from a lot of parents. A lot of parents would message me and they would say, Jordan, we think it's great you talk about this, but like, what else can help our child? Because we're not able to afford this. Our insurance either won't cover it, or our child is not old enough to go into school yet. And I would get different messages like that. And it honestly just broke my heart, if I'm honest, because I know that as we were talking about like my speech therapy timeline, like there was a difference when I got in the research evidence-based services and when I got in the approach that I had needed. And I know from my own lived experience that was very, very much the case. And it just honestly, it really broke in my heart. And I was like, well, what could like we do for the family? So I personally began doing a lot of like a, I personally began doing a lot of appeal writing to insurance companies, but you will do that like all day long you could. So that was taking away time from, the child getting the services. And I really am a firm believer that that time does really, really matter. And we need to give the child access to communication as soon as we possibly can, because every person needs access to communication. So I founded the Apraxia Foundation, where basically how we help families is that we're able to give out grants for speech services, then also for AAC. So we've been able to give out grants for the past 2 years now, and we've been able to grant a total of over $15,000 for speech therapy, and then also a total of 12 AACD devices as well. So we are a volunteer board. All of our board members are in volunteer positions, and the reason why that is that we really want the funds to go to the family. So we make it our mission for all of the funds that we fundraise to be distributed back into the community through our grant. So I really love the Apraxia Foundation. It really has a very special place in my heart because I personally know what it's like to be a child and not be able to say what you want to say and how frustrating that can be. And then also as a child that didn't have access to AAC because of all the misconceptions of AAC is what also drives me to advocate for AAC and for those misconceptions to also not be something that prevents a child or a person being able to communicate.
You're looking at an AAC professor here too.
We can talk about AAC. I love AAC.
I know you watch, so I don't know how familiar you are, but a big frustration of mine is that some of these companies require the CCC for people to order devices from their company. And I'm not going to call them out here because some of them are willing to meet with me, and a lot of has been going on in my life, so I've had to cancel some meetings. But it's so frustrating because that's an access issue. You've got highly qualified speech language pathologists who could be ordering devices, but now can't or want to let their CCC go and won't because they know they won't be able to order those devices. So that's on my advocacy radar. I'll be picking that up soon. I put together some AAC warriors, I'm calling them, to help me with this mission because I can't do all of this alone. And I need,
Absolutely, you need help.
yeah, I need some clinicians to pick up where I left off and take some of these meetings. But that's so frustrating to me that a proprietary product is required to order a piece of equipment that someone could really use and need.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love
Yes.
AAC. As you're talking about your 501c3, I've got philanthropy in me. I like to raise the money. And so I'm sitting here thinking, like, how cool would it be if that foundation just gave away the books to every kid with apraxia of speech? You need a book for a kid? Here it is off our stack. You need to raise some money to so that those books can be purchased, just to give away for free.
As I would love it, I would love that, or as I would love to be able to, it's I would love for like the Apraxia Foundation as well, as I would love for it to grow and for it to help as many families as
Yeah.
we possibly can, because at the end of the day, that's the full mission.
I told a friend today that as part of Fix SLP, as I continue to grow this movement and this advocacy firm, and I'm thinking about all of the people that I'd eventually like to bring on to help me, a philanthropy, like a director of philanthropy, is on my list of things, even if it was a part-time paid position, to be doing good things like that, raising some money for your foundation to give away some books, or Kevin, who was already on, raising some money to give away free sensory haircuts to families that can't afford them. I've got that in me. So I don't know, it's coming. Check back in 5 years. I need a nap first. Talk about
Sure.
your tour.
Yeah, so I've been on the Jordan's World tri or not triology, it's trilogy is how you pronounce it. But what's really funny though is that when I went to my first five book tours, I said triology. I find that funny personally because that's such an apraxia person thing for me. But I was on the Jordan's World trilogy tour. That's a difficult word. And now I'm on the Fighting for My Voice, the movement tour, where we are breaking up the tour into different chapters. So I just finished up chapter one of the tour. And the next part of the tour will be chapter two. And within every chapter of the tour, we are coming out with a list of different cities and different dates that I am going to. And what Fighting for My Voice, the movement is for me personally, is that as I go into these different dates and different locations, I am doing advocacy work within the different dates and locations that I am in. But I also, as well, when I met the tour's top, and when we have our a event, I share some about my autobiography that I have written, as well as share my children's books as well. So those are some of the things that we do get to do. We typically also, as well, we have like a Q&A portion where the audience gets to interact with me. And that's one of my favorite parts because I love being able to interact with people. So those are some of the things that I do on the tour, but I really wanted to hold it as well, not only for like the ad advocacy work and getting able to share like my upcoming published work as well as my previous work. But then also as well, just something that I really love about it within like this current theme of my life is that I had really made a mission within the past year to be my full authentic self. And that's really what Fighting for My Voice, the movement, is for me, is being able to embrace your full authentic self and allowing others to have the space to do so as well. So that's why I really wanted to call it the movement, because I want people to be their authentic selves. I want people to be who they are. It's no matter the theme of what I talk about or what the subject matter is, everything has one thing in common, and the one thing in common that it has is that it's okay to be who you are. As you were saying before we began recording, that it's okay to be your unapologetic self. And if there's one thing that people can take away from me, I hope it's that, because I feel like too many people struggle with that, and it's not. And I know what that's like, and that can be a really dark place, and I just don't want anybody else to feel that way.
You're amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Can I be your roadie on your tour?
What does roadie mean?
It
Just
like
roadie?
groupie. Like I'm gonna get a van and I'm gonna follow you around on my tour. Oh, I'm not on your tour bus, on my own bus.
I don't have a tour bus. I wish I did.
Well, let's get you a tour bus and maybe I could drive it.
Isn't that really expensive? I don't want
Probably.
to have that.
Let's
Maybe
start a
one
501c3 and raise money for it.
tour bus.
We were talking that we're both actually introverts. We can have silent snacks and reading time. We could listen to some music, not interact at all, and just enjoy each other's company.
Okay, so first, would the music be Taylor Swift?
It can be. I
Doesn't
mean,
have to be a rule on the tour bus. As long as we could have that, I'm good with everything else.
yeah, I'm into it.
That's so funny.
Right, so with for the tour, you haven't come out with the next like chapter two locations, but if I could arrange a chapter two right here in Ohio, right where I live, Youngstown, Ohio, where there's a low population, and it would make complete sense for you to come. No university with a speech program, not a lot of people. Get the tour bus and drive through. At least.
I can drive through it.
All
I
right.
can do that. And so I
But
would love to come if it worked out.
so I collected some answers from our fearless fixers who have questions for you.
Yeah.
I'll just go in order. We'll just ask them all.
That's a
These are unscreened. We're gonna just go in. We'll cut them out if they're bad. Who was the best SLP you have had and why? And who was the worst you had and why? I think we already know who the worst one was. You don't have to give that person's name, but
yeah.
what about the best? Shout that person out.
Well, that's so funny. So we know who the worst one was. I think that might best SLP, honestly, would probably have to be like my third grade SLP. I cannot think of her name, but I'll have to ask my mom if she knows her name and get it back to you. But she was really, really awesome, and she really, really worked with me. And then I also loved the ESY SLP I had every year because she was an SLP who let me like play during our sessions. She did not make me sit down in my seat and not move and force me to give eye contact, which we're not neurodiversity affirming, and we don't love to see that. It just made me really anxious and nerve-wracked. So
Okay. I would love if your SLPs were fearless fixers. So figure out their names. We'll find them on social and tag them.
yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. I don't know about this one. I bet I can guess your answer. How has the CCC and that entire system made it harder for you to find an SLP who is competent in childhood apraxia of speech? Has it yet? Has it affected you yet?
So no, so not for me personally, not yet. So I wouldn't.
What state are you in?
I'm in North Carolina. So where your law just recently passed, I'm in the state.
Yeah. So that would be the other thing is that most speech pathologists in North Carolina have their C's because, interestingly, speech pathologists actually didn't have to have their C's. It wasn't part of the regulations, but Medicaid did not have a way for clinicians without their C's to prove their competence, basically. So even though they said you don't have to have your C's to become a Medicaid provider, you had to ha show proof of your C's because there wasn't any other way to fulfill the requirements. So that's what just happened last week is Medicaid created a pathway for people without their CCCs to enroll and be a Medicaid provider. So that's really exciting. So
Yay.
we'll check back with you in a few years. You can tell us if it's impacting your ability. Hopefully the answer is it's never impacting your ability.
Yeah, that's what I would personally hope so. I hope that that's not.
Do you care if your SLP has the CCC?
No, I don't. And that's kind of why I had troubles with like the last question when I was fully thinking through it. I find that that's a great question, of course, but just because a person doesn't have their CCCs doesn't mean that they wouldn't. It's just.
Competence is based on training, teaching, and experience, not a forced certificate product.
Exactly. And that's what I was going for, but I didn't know how to phrase that, so
Yeah,
thank you.
you're welcome. Okay, how about this one? How has speech therapy affected you and your life?
So very, very, so I mean, it's very much a effect of mine, and that's why I'm such an advocate for it and for the SLP field, because from being a child that couldn't speak until he was 5, and then in words at age 8, sentence structure began at age 12, but like forming sentences beyond the age of 12 was still very difficult for me. You know, it's really, really helped me. Now, of course, there's been some ways that it's not so well affected me as well. So when I was just speaking like a few moments ago that there's some SLPs that wanted me to like sit down in my chair and like try to force me to make eye contact, like those had more so negative effects on me than I would personally say good effects on me. So just with that, I would try to keep mindful at having neurodiversity affirming practices. But yeah, it's really, really helped me. So that's why I'm such an advocate for it.
Is he connected at all to current researchers? His reels mention mental exhaustion repeatedly.
So would that mean, if I can ask, like, would that mean like, is he like talking to researchers? Or maybe like, do I know what research currently says on it? Maybe. I know both answers.
Let's hear both answers.
So one with the current researchers, what I have heard of is that they have did very small trials of this, and that they don't find that it's significant enough. And then I, the second question.
Researchers, are you talking to researchers?
So I'm not talking to researchers for that part, but I know what they have said within like previous like conferences and such, because I do have certain people who report back to me, but I'm not allowed to say their names because then they could get in trouble. So I have a little few SLP friends that will come to me and they'll be like, this is what they're saying, this is what they're saying. And I'm like, thank you, give it to me.
It's good to have moles everywhere. Just little moles. Fix
Yeah,
SLP
I
has
have
some.
little moles that travel to these things for me. It's really funny. But yeah, but I basically heard right now from a research site that they don't have enough data, in other words, is how I would phrase it to support it. But we're also as well, I think that's something that is just worth noting is that most of the time we are going to test children who might not be as self-aware as a 27-year-old that's went to not only speech therapy for 12 years, but I've also been in therapy for 6 years. I'm very, very self-aware as a person. So like I'm very in tuned with like my internal processes and just all of the things regarding that, versus if we're going to test this in populations of children with childhood apraxia of speech, they're going to probably be like, what is this person talking about? If you mental exhaustion. So I think the research is very vital, but I also find it's also vital to live to hear from the lived experiences, of course.
Okay, last question. This one is from Jeanette, owner of Fix SLP. What's your number one piece of advice for speech pathologists?
I think that my best piece of advice for SLPs would, I think, would really be to know. I think that there's a lot of messages that can be sent to SLPs even through like course training or through a certain amount of classes. Just the language that people can use is sometimes the link is sometimes the language can resemble that we need to fix speech disorders, or that there's something that we need to get rid of, quote unquote, and like that is the goal of an SLP. I've had a few SLP friends say that this was like how it was worded to them when they were in like their early years, like when they were graduating. I would just say it is to know that the point of these services, of course, is to help build communication, and communication being the primary goal. And that, of course, like the words that you use within the session, of course, and how we might talk about a child's disability, just for example, the adults' voices around them as children typically become their internal voices. So as we're talking about these different types of things, we want to be sure that this is the way that we want the child to also think about, having a apraxia, if they have a apraxia. If this is a person who stutters, like, what do we want them to grow up and to believe about this? And I will say that that's something that I wish was heavily taken more into consideration when I was growing up, for sure, because I was fed a lot of messages that this is something that I should outgrow one day, get rid of. And then I had to unlearn that and really learn that, as we've been talking about, like there's nothing wrong with being different, that you can be you. But just when those early on years were spent a lot differently and they looked a lot different for me, it made it much harder to be able to unlearn that. But it is possible, of course, but we want to avoid that as much as possible.
Great advice to end the episode.
Thank you.
Perfect. Just another great episode.
Thank you.
All right, guys. If you're still with us, I bet this was a long episode. Thank you for sticking with us to the end. Give us a 5-star rating and review if you love what we're doing. We do not have a Patreon, but we do have a sustaining partnership program. We'd love $5 a month per listener or supporter. You can get more information about that at fixslp.com, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for fixing it. You ready? This is the best day of my life.
Oh, thank you.
I just told that to Kevin, who's the singing SLP, and my husband John. Remember I told you I like gave you a little shout out at the episode that was dropping today? My husband John just heard it. He's like, "Did you hear the end of your podcast?" I was like, "Yes," and I'm about to propose again.
You're so funny. Oh my goodness, you.
Never mind that he doesn't like girls.
Yeah.
Never mind that I'm married. Shoot your shot.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm not. Yeah, it doesn't work for me.
Did you just say it doesn't work like that? I'm dying.